Marilyn Waring, Professor of Public Policy, AUT University in Auckland, New Zealand. And my presentation will be on the economics of dignity. And the dignity will be concerning those people who are caregivers, and in particular children, and a question of children's agency. And I'll be relating that to the new provisions in Scotland for carers and young carers, and asking questions about their dignity. Kia ora tātou. Jackie, thank you very much. The Economics of Dignity was the title of a book that three colleagues and I worked on for the Commonwealth Secretariat. And as with a great deal of research, the title comes to you right near the end. And so when I was asked to come and address you, I've been having further reflections on the economics of dignity, because I come from a personal experience of living and being in the carer environment. For 14 of the last 18 months, I managed the care and cared for my father after melanoma roots invaded the nerve tunnels to the brain stem. And it took 14 months for all of that to happen. And he was in a rest home for the last 5 weeks. And in this time, he told me that he'd lost both his sanity and his dignity. And it's an interesting word, dignity. It's the most fundamental of human rights. And Article 1 of the United Nations Declaration is the one that says all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. And my father knew exactly what he meant when he said he had lost his dignity. He was well cared for, but simple things such as not being able to use the toilet in private, his complete dependence on others for hygiene and sanitation, meant for a man who was 88, you know, and of that era, that he had felt he lost his dignity. There were some interesting moments. When I insisted that my dad had to be fed, they replied that they did not want to undermine his independence. He had palsy, he had a swollen tongue, he could not swallow, and he poured food down his front all the way to his shoes when he tried to help himself. My dad wanted his dignity, not his independence. And similar stories were told to the House of Lords and House of Commons, Joint Committee on Human Rights, on the human rights of older people in healthcare. And in presenting the Alex Comfort lecture in 2008, Brenda Hale, the Right Honourable the Baroness, Hale of Richmond, I think she is, said, "I do think that the human rights values of dignity, respect for individuals, privacy, and non-discrimination have so much to offer in the care," she says, "of older people, but frankly, in the care of all people. They should inform everything that policymakers, regulators, providers, and carers try to do, difficult though it often is." We may not have studied dignity in philosophy or law classes, but I suggest we all know a loss of dignity when we see it or experience it. Yes, the preamble to the French Constitution of 1946 requires protection of the dignity of a person from all forms of degradation. We expect to find dignity in the constitutions of Germany and South Africa, given the histories of Nazism and apartheid. Article 1 of the German Basic Law reads, "The dignity of man shall be inviolable. To respect and protect it shall be the duty of all state authority." And Section 10 of the Constitution of South Africa states, "Everyone has inherent dignity and the right to have their dignity respected and protected." And I think for most of us, any international news bulletin shows people living in indignity by anyone's standards. Well, philosophers such as Kant and Dworkin have contended that it's impossible to separate self-respect from respect for the importance of the lives of others. So if I treat others with indignity, I'm also debasing myself. There have been criticisms made of United Nations human rights covenants in general that rights like dignity are individualistic, not collective or communitarian. And many indignities, and the Holocaust and apartheid are obvious examples, are aimed at peoples or communities or indigenous or cultural or religious minorities. At the same time, dignity can't be wrapped up in a nice tight little box with a rigid meaning, because human dignity applies to our individual lives and all of their riot of difference. There's always got to be room for the application of the concept in policy directed towards strategic, practical outcomes. We have to move dignity from a concept to a process to a practice to an outcome. And so sometimes it does need to be tied down. I'm going to talk a little bit more now about dignity. Then I'm going to talk about the nature of the research that we did in the Commonwealth Secretariat. And what we looked at were what was happening to the lives of the carers of those with HIV and AIDS. I'm going to discuss how we began that work, thinking that we were going to look at the value of all the unpaid work of the carers. And after we'd done an extensive literature review, actually we shifted the focus of all of the work. And we shifted the focus to what we called a capability approach in respect of the carers. And this capability approach was developed by a man called Amartya Sen. And it's very interesting. It moves right beyond what the old Aristotelian notion of equality, all people are born equal, which of course they are not, might mean. And so capability is about what needs to be put in place for each person to be able to do and to be and to fulfill their humanness in terms of all of their human rights, dignity being one of those. And we didn't think that question had ever been asked of those people who are full-time caring, unpaid for someone. I started to do some research soon after Alison had made contact, and I came upon the statement of intent and then the policy for the Scottish Government for carers and young carers. So after I've talked through what we did in the field work, the Commonwealth, and some of the issues of capability that were prominent, I'm going to move some of that learning to question the process and implementation around the new policy in Scotland, and particularly focused on agency of young carers. So that's where we're moving. That's where we're trying to go. Most recently, Dignity's got a lot of airtime in the gay marriage debates, particularly in Canada and South Africa. And once the courts had made the decisions there, the precedents from those really flowed into a number of other countries if there were going to be legal challenges, or they affected the political momentum for change. So in the Court of Appeal in Ontario in 2003, it's hard to think, you know, now, isn't it, 12 years ago, that the first gay marriages occurred legally. And the court stated, "The case is ultimately about the recognition and protection of human dignity and equality in the context of the social structures available to conjugal couples in Canada. Human dignity means that an individual or group feels self-respect and self-worth. It's concerned with physical and psychological integrity and empowerment. Human dignity is harmed by unfair treatment premised on personal traits or circumstances which do not relate to individual needs, capabilities, or merits. It is enhanced by laws which are sensitive to the needs, capabilities, and merits of different individuals, taking into account the context underlying their differences. Human dignity is harmed when individuals and groups are marginalised, ignored, or devalued, and it is enhanced when laws recognise the full place of all individuals and groups within Canadian society." So dignity is lived and felt individually. "In caring for my father, my responsibilities filled all my time, and many usual activities were impossible. Temporarily, I could not avail myself of all my human rights. But in all the range of emotions I went through, I did not lose my dignity. A major breakthrough in human rights issues in the fields of those being cared for and those doing the caring was made when Cheryl and Philip Hutchinson took on the Ministry of Health and Senior Citizens in British Columbia and the Human Rights Commission in British Columbia." And the particular characteristics of this case, I think, have specific questions to raise about the new regime in Scotland. The case focused on the validity of a ministry policy which prohibited the hiring of family members by adults with disabilities who qualified for and received ministry funding to cover the cost of long-term in-home care services. The policy constituted a blanket prohibition against hiring family members and applied regardless of whether the funding arrangement involved direct payment to the individual or through a homemaker agency as an approved service provider. Ms. Hutchinson was born with cerebral palsy, a condition which led to physical limitations in her childhood and quadriplegia in her adult life. When the case was brought, Ms. Hutchinson was in her 30s. She had postgraduate degrees in music and she was a very successful composer. At the time of the case, she required assistance in all aspects of daily living, including bathing, dressing, toileting, mobility, transfers, meal preparation, and she used a wheelchair. Mr. Hutchinson's father, Philip, had been her primary caregiver since she was 13 years old. In her view, her father was and continued to be her most appropriate caregiver and a major contributing factor to her success, to her independence, to her accomplishments in the face of her disability. In order to provide his daughter with the care she needed, Mr. Hutchinson was forced to leave the workforce. The family had subsisted on limited funds available since 1983. At the time of the hearing, Mr. Hutchinson was 71 years old and continued to be his daughter's primary caregiver. In 1998, Ms. Hutchinson had been accepted as a client of a program called Choices in Supports for Independent Living. Now, what this was, it was a ministry-funded program, and it provided funds directly to qualified adults with disabilities, allowing them some discretion to hire their own caregivers. However, the ministry policy prohibited Ms. Hutchinson from hiring her father for her care using these funds. Now, Mr. Hutchinson did not wish to be his daughter's sole caregiver. He realised he wouldn't be able to care for his daughter forever. He wanted her to be independent. He did, however, wish to be able to be hired as one of his daughter's caregivers under this program. So Cheryl and Philip Hutchinson both filed human rights complaints, alleging that the ministry's policy prohibiting the hiring of family members was discriminatory. Ms. Hutchinson alleged that the ministry's policy discriminated against her on the grounds of both disability and family status, contrary to the code. Mr. Hutchinson alleged that the ministry's policy discriminated against him on the basis of family status, as it prohibited him from being hired by his daughter purely on the basis that he was her father, and not with any consideration of the skills and experience that he may have as a caregiver. Now, the case was very tightly constructed. You can see, you can feel in this case, the tribunal being terrified that they might make a precedent. So the obiter and the judgments are very, very tight. They did not want it to be seen as a universal remedy for all family members who are subject to this sort of discrimination. And the complainants did not challenge the validity of a general prohibition on the hiring of family members. What they challenged was the blanket provision against hiring family members without assessment of individual circumstances according to the program. And we have some very interesting parallels going here already, those of you who are familiar with the new regime in Scotland. So the judgment was very instructive as to the part played by loss of dignity in human rights cases. In Ms. Hutchinson's case, the blanket policy against hiring family members had a significant adverse impact on her dignity because she had high care needs and she had very great difficulties in hiring and retaining appropriate skilled caregivers. The policy did not address her actual needs as a vulnerable person with a severe disability. On the one hand, it offered her the opportunity to choose her own caregiver, and on the other hand, it denied her the opportunity to hire her father, her most appropriate caregiver. The tribunal found that the blanket prohibition impacted most severely on those like Ms. Hutchinson, who were severely disabled, who required 24-hour care and help with all the intimate activities of daily living. It concluded that Ms. Hutchinson had established a prima facie case of discrimination on the basis of disability and found that the ministry's blanket prohibition against hiring relatives offended the Human Rights Code on the basis of family status. It found that Mr. Hutchinson had been discriminated against in seeking employment with no consideration as to Mr. Hutchinson's qualifications or suitability to do the job, and that both Hutchinsons had therefore had their dignity violated. So dignity was really influencing my thinking when I came to work with Robert Carr, Anit Mukherjee and Meenasheev Das on research for the 24/7 caregivers of those with HIV and AIDS. Now, the public health sector is a major expenditure item for any government, whether it's from redistributing national revenues or whether it's from development assistance programs. In the more advanced economies, and certainly in the UK and Europe after the global financial crisis, the economic imperative has seemed to be for health institutions to develop more efficiencies and effectiveness. And operationally, these policy approaches have had rather more focus on outputs than outcomes. And one of the chief manifestations of this approach has been to discharge patients earlier from public care facilities. In many countries where HIV and AIDS is of epidemic proportions and hospitals cannot cope, they just send patients home. In some countries, we found, in fact, there is a deliberate misdiagnosis because the public health system cannot cope with HIV and AIDS, or there is just blatant lies told about it. So, for example, places like Solomon Islands will say, we've never had an AIDS case. In Papua New Guinea, you'll be told you've got malaria and sent home. And this is not an unusual situation. But in making these kinds of policy choices, whether in the West to discharge people earlier, or whether in other developing countries that simply can't cope, there's a presumption that at home there's a vast reserve army of unpaid labour available to immediately resume responsibility for the discharged patient. In other situations, there's increasing pressure on governments for the provision of ever more sophisticated and expensive secondary and tertiary care facilities, at a time when studies in health economics demonstrate that the very best investments in healthcare are those associated with prevention and early detection and treatment. And I've always found it a problem that the household is not seen as primary health care, and then the GP is secondary health care, because the first place that primary health care happens is in the home. And there's a real problem around our discourse there, and a real disempowerment around the expertise and experience in caring that is found in households. So there are economic costs in respect of the invisibility of the unpaid work in the household. We know this from the growing number of national and other time use surveys, from surveys on unpaid work and healthcare, from decades of narratives captured in a wide range of social science literature, and from our own observations and experience. Insufficient or inadequate care at the onset of illness in the home can exacerbate its severity with costs incurred across sectors. This occurs from the loss of labour from the market sector, the loss or diminution of unpaid service or productive and reproductive activities, either when the usually woman in the household is ill or because she has to forego all the other household activities of keeping the place running and turning over because of the amount of time now required to carry out caring work, or when a child is removed from school to carry or to assist in carrying out caring roles, and with known outcomes for longer term illness, with increasing possibilities of poor nutrition or poverty or hunger and a range of other vulnerabilities. And it's also important to remember that the household work includes the daily maintenance of well-being, which tends to be even more invisible than caring for the sick. Those are issues around hygiene, around sanitation, around a clean environment, all the daily household routines that enable a healthy, paid, formal workforce to remain productive in the economy. So, to the work that we looked at doing for the Commonwealth. When I did the literature review, what I found was that the challenges were so complex, so diverse from country to country, almost household to household, rural to urban, etc., that for us to sail into the field and to do a time use survey and then to try and quantify what that was worth and then possibly to give it, you know, a market value was frankly going to be an academic exercise because we weren't going to provide any form of strategic learning or any form of outcome that might possibly change. The issues, for example, included, they're in no particular order. The access to or ability to utilise information. Many carers didn't get information. I cared for my, I'm a very bright, assertive woman. I hate to think how much medication my father was on near the end. Everybody who visited knew his swallowing mechanism had gone. Nobody said to me ever, Marilyn, how much of this medication can be given now in liquid form? Every night I stood with my father while he tried to swallow 16 bloody pills. Nobody said you can mash these ones up in jam or yogurt. I'm not stupid, right? But even I wasn't being advised or being given information that would have made that better. Loads of the carers we were talking about weren't literate or weren't in any way able to get information. I joined one of my colleagues was putting together, you know, one of those cross-disciplinary research teams that you do. And this was about care. And I went to the first sort of round table, and the guys all from creative technology were there, you know. And the thing they were most excited about was designing an app for caregivers, right? And I, first of all, you think to yourself, they can't have ever cared for anybody. I mean, actually, it doesn't work to timetable. People don't go to the toilet at appointed times. People don't sleep when it says. And if somebody thought that they were going to give me something that was going to buzz and give me yet another stress in my life, I would run screaming from the room. Schooling gets interrupted. Income generation and subsistence activities diminish. The household has less food, especially for children. Young carers are the most invisible. Loan repayments are threatened or cease, damaging extended family and community relationships. Nearly everything is worse and harder if you're rural. The spread of HIV and AIDS is much more likely in violent households. Whole households were subjected to community stigma. No provision of disinfectant, gloves, soaps, bandages, painkillers. No access to clean water. Time poverty. No access to or use of condoms. No hygienic living conditions. No respite at all for carers. No transport. No counselling. Hopelessly inadequate infrastructure. No labour-saving devices of the simple grating, threshing, milling, pounding, drying, cooking kind. Deteriorating health of everybody in the household. No fuel, whether wood, dung, gas, kerosene, paraffin or charcoal. Wives and daughters sent to care for HIV-positive relatives of the males in their households who might live hundreds of miles away. Male carers being seen as deviant and unmanly. Orphans. So the literature review, these are just some of the things that came out of the literature review, made it obvious that the research focus in the field would be most usefully situated in a rights-based framework focused on the dignity of the caregiver. In a capability approach. And it highlighted different impacts on carers by age, by cultural expectations, by religion, by sexual orientation, by gender, with most of this overlaid by stigma. Now, often, you know, research teams sit down and think that really what they want to achieve is a kind of mission impossible, but you write the wish list anyway. We were all attending the international HIV conference in Mexico City, and between all the workshops and everything, we grabbed about an hour to sit down. And we wrote a wish list of the kind of sample that we would like to participate, both the country and the kind of household that we were looking for. And I must say that we did do it with a smile on our face and we chuckled because we thought this was, you know, at the odds of our actually managing to secure participants from these particular countries with all of these particular issues were very long. So it was extraordinary. We nailed every single one. It went like this. Bangladesh, we want an intravenous drug user in an Islamic household. Botswana, we'd like a nuclear family in receipt of food aid. And Canada, we'd really like a woman prisoner. In Guyana, we want a woman-headed household where there's violence. In India, sex worker. In Jamaica, a gay man. In Namibia, a grandmother. In New Zealand, transgender. In Nigeria, a Muslim woman in a compound caring for relatives. Papua New Guinea, subsistence rural. Uganda, a child carer in one of the Christian centres. We got all of them. And the material that we collected was extraordinary. Now, how did we next do this? So we sat down with the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, CEDAW, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, and the Convention on the Rights of the Child. We then, right by right, where it made sense, translated each one of those rights into a question. So, did you have any choice about becoming the primary caregiver? That's a human rights question. Did you have any choice? Nobody had any choice. Things like, does anyone ever come to give you some rest? All human beings are entitled to leisure and rest and recreation. Do you have enough to eat? How is your own health? Are you able to do any work outside the home? Even things like, can you go to any community or political meetings, which comes straight out of the Civil and Political Covenant? Okay, I'm not going to go through them all, but I wanted to show you how you can build the human rights capability questions. I notice, you see, that every carer in Scotland is going to have an assessment. The person cared for has an assessment, but apparently the new policy says every carer is also to have an assessment. And I don't know quite what questions are going to be asked in this assessment, but it would seem to me that the capability approach, ensuring that the human rights of the caregiver are part of the full assessment, would be a very interesting way to go. Have you ever had a holiday? None of them had. And just for a minute, reflect on the question of rights and imagine the compromised rights of these carers, and many of them children, to quote, safe and healthy working conditions, to leisure, to education, their own right to health, to full enjoyment of life, which is another international human right. This is how the capability approach works. We don't presume that everybody is equal and has the same chance. We understand something has intervened so that circumstances make it impossible for carers to enjoy the same rights. Now, what a capability approach says is not, oh, well, that's too bad. It says, what do we have to do? What has to be changed in this environment so that you can be free to enjoy those rights? Okay? Being a caregiver should not condemn you to no rights. One of the very clear findings was that few carers had human rights. They had no choice at all. They did not choose the work. They had no time to enjoy their capabilities. And one of the South African cases on socioeconomic rights says, there can be no doubt that human dignity, freedom and equality, the foundational values of our society, are denied those who have no food, clothing or shelter. I'd go further and I'd say it's denied those who are hungry. Right? It's denied those whose health is failing because they're having to care. We argued that, in fact, none of our carers had the capability to enjoy human rights. In the next piece of research that I understood with the Commonwealth Secretariat, we looked at social protection. So we took the learning from HIV and AIDS work to begin to look at social protection. And in two particular schemes, we looked at children in Swaziland and Kenya, child carers in these countries. Excuse me, can we give her a glass of water here? We've got water.
Can we? Oh,
okay. In Swaziland, the very high infection rate of HIV and AIDS has left 34% of children without their biological parents. More than 130,000 children have been orphaned. The burden of care has fallen mainly on female grandparents or community support systems. But 6% of households are now headed by children, and 1% of those are headed by girls aged under 14. And one of the key projects in Swaziland, in all 320 chieftains and in the 12 towns, has been to ensure the inheritance rights of children are safeguarded and recognised in land titles and in the allocation of land. And on set days, everyone in the community who can goes to work on the plots that have been allocated or will be inherited by these children to provide nutrition and livelihoods for the orphans, to provide for the fees for their education, to teach them how to work the land, what crops to plant, what pests are a problem, how to rotate, what companion planting is, etc. Access and control of land and property are seen as the key factors in reducing the vulnerability of orphans. In Kenya, the HIV and AIDS pandemic facilitated huge disinheritance and asset stripping. And the issue arose indirectly. There's a wonderful women's NGO there called Groots, and they had a program on caring for those with HIV and AIDS. But it was always difficult to continue because the women and children who they had in the program would never be there for very long. So what was happening? Well, disinheritance was happening when they went to investigate it. So I imagine, in fact, that there are similar situations for those who have been and still are affected by Ebola, by earthquakes, by tsunami, by destructive weather and geological forces, by man-made war, by other catastrophes. Children are orphaned by traumatic events. Now, as a result, Groots developed a new program. They're so funny. So, they recruited and trained women in everything to do with land titles. How to register land, how to ensure that wills were made for inheritance of land, etc. And whenever a person became terminally ill, these uniformed, you should see them all dressed up in their uniforms, they're kind of a slightly military looking uniforms, they come to the village and they meet the chiefs and they have all the information needed. Because this is what we call anticipatory social protection. You, as soon as someone is ill, you can, in these conditions, anticipate what is going to happen. Okay? There is a lot we can anticipate in illness, in care, in the West. We can anticipate these things when we have terminal illnesses. We have loads now that we know about dementia. There are huge numbers of things that we can anticipate. There's no reason for social protection to be reactionary and responsive all the time. It ought to be far more anticipatory. So the women would come in and they'd have the registration of land titles and they'd get the signed inheritance arrangements, whose land is very significant in Africa. It tells your family identity, where you come from, your heritage. It's your shock absorber. It's your social protection. But the best part I like about this story and the women in uniform is that nearly all the chiefs and everybody in the village, because they come, they've got all the papers and they're in uniform, thinks they come from the government and they never disabuse anybody of that belief. Now, in these cases and in other exploratory research in Western Kenya, some children, you know, one of the things that happens is loads of times people talk about it, the children as if they're victims, right? Talk about their neediness, there's a lot written about their resilience, right? But in fact, these children, they manage to mobilise social support. Given the land, they engage in income-generating activities. One of the really important learnings is that we move beyond gender stereotypes because the work just has to be done. So young boys caring, young women carrying, income generating, whatever it is. Loads and loads of the stereotypes break down in these households just because the work has to be done. They construct some positive identities for themselves and their households despite the tremendous adversity. And these things are best mobilised when the children are given agency in their own lives. Now, what that means is that you don't have a whole lot of adults running around saying 14-year-old girls shouldn't be heading households. 14-year-old girls know that it is safer for them and their siblings to be in their own household than an uncle's household. A great deal safer. So we have to work out a way in the West to implement that same kind of understanding and that same form of agency. So what might the equivalent be? Okay, well, the UK census in 2001 was the first to include a question on health, disability, and the provision of care. It showed more than 1 million people working more than 50 hours a week in unpaid care for family members, friends, neighbours, and others because of long-term physical or mental ill health or disability or problems relating to old age. In the UK, more than 175 children under 18 were acting as carers, including 13,000 under 18 providing more than 50 hours of care a week. Of people aged 65 and over, more than 380,000 cared for others for more than 50 hours a week. In Scotland, 9.5% of the population, 422,000 people, provided unpaid care, and 116,000 provided more than 50 hours a week. This is according to the UK Census 2001. In 2010, the BBC surveyed more than 4,000 secondary school students and found an invisible army of 8% of those participants working in their households as carers. This is considerably higher than the census figures, but most academics will tell you that the stigma, number one, of admitting some disabilities, and number two, of admitting that children are the caregivers, mean that there's always going to be underrepresentation in the census figures. Indeed, the figures for the 2007-2008 Scottish Household Survey showed 657,000 unpaid adult carers and 100,000 unpaid young carers. Way greater than the 2011 UK census. Now, I'm aware of the Children and Young People Act, passed in 2014 in the Scottish Parliament. And I've also been following the various documents and policy changes related to young carers. And there might be some other developments in Europe that I will hear about, but I understand that this is a leading central government effort compared with anywhere else to put children and young people at the heart of planning and services and trying to deliver more than just words on the page. So I was very interested in the reflections of the Young Carers Project in Stirling, who appeared, where the young caregivers appear to have some similar capability issues to those that we found in developing countries. A lack of transport, a lack of information, a lack of services, few if any shops with fresh produce to enable healthy eating, long school journeys, few or no leisure activities. And I'm especially interested in this as the Scottish Government moves towards carers' assessments and what those questions are going to be. We can have the old clinical assessment, you know, let me take your blood pressure kind of approach, or we can have a capability assessment. And I'd hope that a capability assessment based on human rights might be a basic ingredient. I'm particularly interested in the new regulations which set out the circumstances where a supported person can employ a close relative as a personal assistant. Now, at the moment, the rules say this includes where the person requires palliative care, where there are limited service providers, or where there are religious or cultural beliefs. The range of appropriate circumstances does not seem to pass the Hutchinson test. It does not appear to me, given these rules, that you can, in fact, hire the best possible carer available if that carer is a member of your family. So I'd be interested to know if the implementation of this strategy is or is not passing the Hutchinson test. And the next issue of interest to me is what happens to child carers who effectively qualify for this support? Okay, we've got two issues going here now. Maybe the most effective carer happens to be a child. Now, is everybody going to say, oh, that's impossible, can't possibly do that. You know, you can't have a choice, you know, it's a child. Or Scotland, having shown itself ready to lower the age of participation in the referendum and then in voting, at what point in their caring roles are children going to be given the agency to be paid as caregivers? And the introduction of the carers assessment is also interesting to me because of this named person that this child carer is going to have. Because every child's going to have a named person, right? And when we come to assess the impact of dignity on the child carer, just whose point of view is it going to be? Is it going to be the child's view of their dignity? Or is the named person going to assume that they can speak for the dignity of the child carer? When a policy that says that carers need to be more involved in decisions about the planning and provision of cared for persons and about support for themselves, will the child carers be listened to and given agency? Whose dignity counts here? So I think there are some very interesting tests ahead for Scotland's new policy. And if any of you have any stories about implementation at this point, I'd be interested to hear them. Thank you.